Good afternoon. You're listening to KYRS. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I've got a new show for you featuring an interview that I took just yesterday down in Portland. Scooped up a couple of good interviews when I was down there this weekend that I'm going to share with you over the next few weeks, along with lots of other stuff. So I realized in making this interview that the worker and organizer I interviewed is actually the same person I talked to on the phone 3 years ago. So a worker at Burgerville in Portland, which you may know, the Burgerville Workers Union is the only federally recognized fast food workers union in the country. And just this week, there's been a lot of news in Portland as Little Big Burger, another local to the Portland area burger chain, announces that it is organizing a union as well called the Little Big Union. Nice play on the IWW, one big union there. So that's all happening just this week. So I was able to sit down with Luis Brennan to talk about his role in the union there and what the workers have been up to. I realized that it's the same person that I spoke to on my May Day 2016 show by phone. So if you're curious about a perspective from a few years ago when this work was first starting and you want to do a side-by-side, you can find that old show in the archive of the podcast at soundcloud.com/praxisradio. Just scroll back in time until you get to May Day 2016. So that's just kind of an exciting continuation. So I'm going to get this interview started for you, and then at the end of the show, have some interesting on this day in history stuff that happens to be radical labor history. Today is a day for labor history, so stick around and find out about that at the end of the show. So without further ado, here is this interview, and if you have questions about the show, topic ideas, anything like that, you can always reach me by emailing me at praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S at KYRS.org.
If you can just start by introducing yourself, talking a little bit about who you are and the work that you've been doing.
Hi, my name is Luis Brennan. I'm a member and organizer with the Burgerville Workers Union. I've been working at Burgerville for 4.5 years and I've been organizing. We've had a union public at Burgerville for 3 years now. Our anniversary is coming up next month. We are currently the only federally recognized fast food union in the country after winning 3 elections at 3 different Burgervilles. And we're fighting for a fair contract and trying to spark a movement around the country for low-wage workers.
Cool. So we realized that we talked 3 years ago when the first union was coming into being, right, at the first Burgerville that you unionized. So can you just kind of map out the journey? Like, how did this start at Burgerville? Like, was there a catalyzing moment? And then, like, how has the movement grown since then?
So, yeah, I mean, we started really as a network of workers at Burgerville who wanted a change and who also were really inspired by organizing fast food workers at other parts of the country and the fast food strikes and the movement of low-wage workers generally. And so when we launched, we weren't actually sure whether we wanted to go the federally recognized route or whatever. We really understood that workers acting together collectively is a union. So the first thing we did is we just launched our union. We formed an organization of Burgerville workers, got support from our friends and comrades on the outside, and then launched. And then we really had to figure out how we were going to get the boss to decide to treat us like we deserve. Went through lots of twists and turns and took a lot of actions. And we have continued to take a lot of actions, whether that's strikes, in shop, small things like wearing buttons and stuff, having pickets with community supporters, and lots of different things. We even launched a boycott, which is still on for those of you who come into the Burgerville, come all the way east to the Dalles, west to the Dalles, then don't go to Burgerville because it's a little boycott. We've been putting pressure, and then a few years back, about a year ago, we filed for an election at 2 different Burgerville locations. We won those elections, which made us the first since the 80s federally recognized fast food union, and the only existing in the country today. And now we're at the bargaining table, and we've kept on adding more units. One store had an election last December. Two more filed for election 2 weeks ago, and you know, we're now we're in this process of trying to sort of solidify our gains and set ourselves up as an anchor for a broader movement.
So, I feel like low wage work is an interesting world in this country, and when there's fights, these broader ideas of like raising the minimum wage, I feel like burger flippers are like the cliche group to bring up, right? And say, when they pit workers against each other, and for kind of medium wage workers to say, well, I don't want to make the same amount as a fast food worker. So what has it been like just politically to have fast food like be the realm that this is happening?
Well, I think there's been a lot of gains made, especially in that the ideology of things, like you're pointing to. We've actually gotten a lot of support from building trades and things like that, which you'd think were the sort of people who are most like, well, I don't, you know, I'm a carpenter. I don't want fast food workers making the same as me or something. But we've done a lot of work to show to people that they that, you know, the strength of workers in general is a strength for all workers, not just fast food workers. It's not pitting people against each other. And also just the basic fact of human dignity. I mean, mm-hmm. We've always felt that if you want your burgers to be made, if you want burgers to be made in this society, then you should want the person who makes the burger flippers to live a decent life. And that doesn't matter whether it's how relative it is to you. And I think we've actually, at least in Portland, made a lot of headway in people seeing the benefit of supporting low-wage workers organizing. Mm-hmm. Pause real quick.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, sorry.
So I guess since the different locations have organized, what have been some of the wins that people have...
Well, so we've gotten a lot of small things, you know. We've gotten some safety stuff, like floor mats at different locations, and getting management to respect people's rights to, they closed one of the restaurants earlier now, so people could use transit. We've gotten some other interesting victories that weren't necessarily combating with the boss, but a worker self-organization. There was a worker who was transitioning and wanted to come out with their preferred gender pronouns. And we really helped that worker with their coworkers sort of organize the shop so everyone was on the same page about what his name was and what his pronouns were. And that was a really beautiful example of, you know, workers organizing together to protect each other, you know. And there have been some gains at the bargaining table. I mean, we've got the companies agreed to just cause, which means that these are all tentative agreements. We haven't signed the whole thing yet. But tentatively, they've agreed to just cause, which means that they'll have to have a good reason to fire somebody or discipline them in general. We've made some headway talking about drug and alcohol policy, you know, because, you know, it's a, one of the things that happens all the time is the company says that you can't smoke marijuana. You have to be able to pass a drug test. But if someone smokes at home, they might fail the drug test. And it's legal in Oregon and Washington. Like, there's no reason why that person should be fired for doing something illegal outside of work. But still, there's this sword hanging over people's heads that if they... if the company really wants to, they can just ask you to pass a drug test, and then you can't, and then you're fired. For basically no reason. So, and the company's budged a little bit on that and changed some of their policies already on it too. So, I think you know, we've got momentum. It is true though that the company is not, we're not out of the woods yet. We, after 11 months, of bargaining, they gave their proposals around what they're willing to give as far as wages go. And they proposed a 13-cent raise. So they waited 11 months to tell us, to give us an offer on what they were giving, and they kept on saying, oh, we're running models, we need to tweak our projections or something. When they finally handed us the piece of paper, it was a 13 cent raise, which our line is, it's not even a nickel and a dime. So, so clearly we need all the support we can get. We need all the community turning out and fellow workers turning out, because this company, is not ready to respect their workers like they say they are quite yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wonder, so what was it like? What has it been like in an ongoing way from the perspective of the workers, of fellow workers? Because I've worked a lot of low-wage jobs, worked a lot of service industry, barista, food service, et cetera. And I think sometimes there's a sense that we're not going to be workers who have power and the boss can do whatever they want, et cetera. What's it been like just on a personal level for people to lean into this and become empowered and build that solidarity together in a culture where that's pretty much lacking?
I mean, I think it's been really important for people. I think especially it's interesting that it happens sort of, every person's story is individual. You know, I wouldn't say that there's so much like a blanket answer to that question, but there's lots of little answers. And what's kind of powerful to me too is that it's there's lots of they keep on happening, you know. It's not a one-off thing. Like, it's just this pressure that people come into this workplace and they experience some sort of some sense of struggle, some dignity. They go on strike, and there's still turnover, right? This is still fast food. There's still lots of turnover. So people will come in and they'll work at the Montevillo Burgerville for, you know, 6 months. But 6 months they'll go on strike and there'll be a picket at their store, and then they have left and they've experienced like a different kind of workplace. And some of those people stick around. I mean, there's people who have left Burgerville but are either active in other, like have become activists in other regards, or they are still helping on with the Burgerville campaign. I think the important thing too is that while yes, it has helped people like feel differently about their lives and all that stuff, the seeds were already there. You know, I think that my coworkers already know that the system is rigged against them and that they need to change, and that they want to fight, and we're a vehicle for that. I think is an important, you know, important facet of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And well, I think we'll get to that in a minute, but, can you share a little bit about what just happened with the, I think it's one of the two locations that's working on the contract right now with the victory you all just claimed?
Yeah. Yeah. This past week? So we've had a wild week. The company for most of the elections that we filed. So for those who don't know, one of the ways you get officially certified as a union federally recognized, which means that the government sort of forces the company to bargain with you, is a union election where you basically petition the government to come in and have a vote. So that's one of the things we've been doing. They've done sketchy anti-union stuff that we're not happy about, but it's in general been relatively quiet. I mean, for those folks who are involved in the labor movement, you hear horror stories of the way bosses behave during union elections. So it hasn't been the worst of the worst. But at this location, which is the convention center location, which is a big moneymaker, but also one that we've been very active at and had multiple strikes and pickets at, and workers have been, some of the core workers there have been involved in the union since the very beginning. We filed for an election, and the day we filed with the government, they wrote up 8 workers. One worker they suspended for not having a name tag, which is not an offense that people get suspended for, typically. They wrote her up. They suspended her for 2 weeks, and this was 2 days before her maternity leave, which was offensive.
Mm-hmm. Kind of a signal that you're probably not coming back.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. And kind of a signal that we don't want you back. Right. Mm-hmm. And certainly a signal that we are not happy with your union affiliation. And what was amazing too is that the union support for workers on the shop floor in that was very strong. There were only three workers who did not sign on to the union petition. So it was a very strong union shop. So the company started this wave of discipline. They disciplined, but in the next 4 days, they disciplined every single person who had signed a petition. And they did, and so far as we knew, they did not discipline the people who were not on the petition. And anecdotally, we heard stories of that managers were being pretty explicit about the fact that this was about the union. So we started organizing. The workers were doing strike prep, talking very openly about the fact that they were going to strike over these this union busting. We went to the media. We got a very juicy story from a local alternative weekly called the Willamette Week. And we went to the community. We did a call in action, where we had our community supporters call Burgerville. And we filed legal charges. We filed, complaints with the National Labor Relations Board. A week of all this pressure, the company came back and offered to rescind all of the disciplines. And there was one worker who was fired, who we were not really, really unsure if she was going to get her job back, but we just found out yesterday that she is back at work. Kashayla's there. So it was a big victory, and we have a negotiation session next week, and hopefully the kind of community power that we've shown, the power that this union has, will impact the company's behavior when it comes to actually putting things across the table. But it's always a really nice feeling to be able to have people's back, mm-hmm. Pull through, and always a terrible, stressful experience to have the company come down and be really just cruel.
Yeah. But also so good to win.
Yeah,
especially
so good to
win. Times like this and labor in general, uh-huh. Just to get a win is pretty sweet.
It's good to get a win.
Yeah.
It's good to get a win. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you say the community support, do you see either at your location where you're working or at the other locations, do people come in? Do customers come in aware of the union and excited about it, or are they just looking for a burger, or is it some mixture?
Well, at this point, we hope our union supporters are not coming into the restaurant because we've called for a boycott. But in the last few years, we've seen a lot of community support, and I think we've managed to get pretty mass attention to our fight, which has only made us stronger. I think Burgerville especially is very attuned to its brand and very attuned to the being a community, you know, Portland-based place. It's a Portland's only around the Portland Vancouver area, we've seen a lot of support, and I think it speaks to the character of Portland. People want to be on the right side of things, and we've done a lot of good work in terms of community organizing. I mean, this is a lesson to other organizers that you don't get that kind of support by asking for it just blanketly. You have to be strategic and smart about building it. So we, you know, spent the time, and we went to the meetings for union locals like the carpenters or the longshoremen or the teachers, and we talked to the other unions. We got their support, and we talked to the community groups and faith leaders, and we constantly tried to figure out ways to collaborate and do that movement building work. That's the core of what has actually built our strength. I think that there's a lot. It's easy for people to think that the way that mass support happens is through media, which is media is crucial, but it's also the sort of real relationship building and organizational relationship building that does puts a scaffolding that can hang on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so you mentioned a little bit. Some ripple effects. Where do you see, I guess, after being part of this movement, where do you see this going in the future in terms of low wage workers in general, especially at like an approachably sized chain like that? You know, this isn't like McDonald's workers, isn't something massive like that. It's something a little more grabbable. Where do you see that rippling out? Are there any other murmurings that are publicly shareable about other workplaces?
Well, there was the big that we're trying to build a union burger union movement in this town. So we very happy to say that another union of burger workers launched their union publicly last weekend. I guess it was 2 weeks ago now, but they at a place called Little Big Burger. Which they launched their union called the Little Big Union, which is a great little pun on a common IWW catchphrase, which is the One Big Union. Now they're fighting for the same stuff we're fighting for, and they're fighting with a whole different company. It's very interesting. It's a local company. At least it was started locally, but they were bought out by a big national private equity company, and so now they've got a different kind of fight on their hands. Hmm. One that I think is a really interesting twist to the story. So I think that we want to see a burger union movement, and I think the more importantly to me, I want to see a union movement of the kinds of workers that work in burger joints, and see a movement where those folks really gain power. And I think that's the we haven't got into it all, but the IWW is a smaller, more sort of volunteer based, sort of passion based organizing project and very member driven. And I think that's a key to things moving forward on a bigger level, because the history of the American labor movement is that workers built the unions. Workers went on in the millions. Formed and joined unions, and if we're going to have the kind of movement that we need, that's what's going to happen again. So I think that our example should be I would love to see our example spark more inspirations, and the fact that there's already a second one means that there's momentum. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we'll see other examples. I've already had lots of We always get contacts from people saying, hey, I want to organize my, warehouse or whatever they're working at, and say, people need it. People are ready to fight. So mm-hmm. I think it's coming.
Yeah. And I guess on that note, because I'm sure a lot of people listening, knowing the demographics of the listeners, and my own demographics, et cetera, a lot of people listening are probably like, well, yeah, I'd love to organize my workplace. So where do you point people when people hit that wall and think, maybe we could do this? I don't know. Can you lay out kind of like just a basic step-by-step, at least for people thinking through it?
Yeah. I mean, the basic step-by-step is you have to build organization with your coworkers. And that's the basic thing. I mean, which is not that complicated. It's building relationships. It's getting to know people's struggles. It's building a common program and vision around what you want to see. And the kernel of every good organizing campaign is the solidarity between the workers and the shop. At some point, to be able to have the big victories, you're probably going to need some outside help. You don't always need outside help. Sometimes you can just march on the boss and demand what you demand and you can actually win some stuff. But if you need outside help, you can look, you have to shop around and ask for unions and whoever has your back. I mean, the IWW is a union for all workers. We've been around for over 100 years. We have a national contact, which is called organizing, the email organize@iww.org. You can always email that and someone will get back to you and give you some advice. But again, the really core of it is building solidarity with your coworkers. So if you want to organize and you think that's what needs to happen, first thing I do is write a list of all my coworkers, figure out who the first people you need to recruit are, and have a meeting and start making a plan and get a team together. From there, there you got to figure it out. But if you have each other's back and you've got a team, then you can make it happen.
Yeah. And this is kind of a sub question and a big future question, mm-hmm. but I know that a lot of what I hear talked about in labor communities and even just like the dreaming in the workplace, talking about how terrible the boss is, et cetera, conversations, a lot of those end up leaning to like worker ownership, like like actually owning the grill itself, the means of production, etc. How does that fit in to this vision with?
Well, I mean, the IWW is an anti-capitalist union. This is an important thing that sets us apart. I mean, we see all these struggles around wages and gender pronouns as beginning phases of a big snowball that hopefully will be able to take over society and run it in a way that's more directed to human need and not just profit. And a worker ownership is a core part of that. I mean, I think that that's ultimately our other slogan is, you don't need the boss needs you. Because we're the ones that do the work. And so we're the ones that not only should reap the benefit from it, but ideally are the ones who would be able to control it. But I think that also, like, you know, we don't need to romanticize worker ownership, because we still live in a capitalist system. And even if you're a worker co-op, you're still going to be subject to the complicated dynamics of the capitalist system. And so maybe that's not for everybody, but I think we do need to be having that horizon in the movement about what it's going to mean to rethink our society and to reorganize our society to be more based about actual people. But this worker ownership piece is gaining momentum. I think if people don't know about Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, they should look it up. It's beginning to have a network of worker cooperatives in predominantly poor Black neighborhoods in Jackson. And there's other historical examples, whether it's the Zapatistas in Chiapas, Mexico, or Mondragon in Spain. There's all these interesting examples of people trying to take control of their economic life. I take them as inspirations, and y'all should too.
Mm-hmm. And it feels like an elephant in the room, but also oddly invisible in so much mainstream political discourse, because people on the right and the left are dissatisfied with corporate oligarchy.
Right.
But we just don't end up talking about it.
Right. Well, I think that's we have to be really, we in the Burgerville Workers Union talk about power a lot. And I think that's something that we don't in our discourse talk a lot about, who has power. And also what power means, you know, whoever's in the White House that's one question. But, and that's a certain kind of power. But the American empire is not run from the White House. It's run from the boardrooms. It's run from the weapons plants. It's run from the, like, propaganda machines that convince us that we should be, you know, pitting against each other instead of uniting against these big wigs in the boardroom. So, I think that... our goal needs to be about who has power, and that power needs to be everybody, right? The goal, it's not just like, okay, so one now, the different group needs to have power. It's that we all need to have power collectively and understand power as a mutual thing, as a cooperative thing, as a collective thing, that we gain strength from each other and really have the courage to be honest that that's not how the world works now. That even if the system might have rules that look like they're based on merit or look like anybody has a chance, that's not the way the system works. It's not built to allow people to rise the ladder and live a good life. It's just built. It's not built that way. And we should build it. We do have the opportunity. We have the power. Mm-hmm. We have the ability to build a world where our lives are respected and we have control over what happens to us. Mm-hmm. We just got to get to it.
Yeah. And we actually have a great window with so many things falling apart at such a rate.
Yeah, certainly. And I think that's, I guess, I haven't thought about that, but this point around things falling apart does actually speak to one of the facts of the fast food worker's life is that marginal workers really are on the forefront of this kind of feeling of collapse in society. I mean, every day my coworkers and myself have a different crisis that disrupts everything that we're doing, and we have to take care of it. And that feeling of living on the edge is unsustainable. And hopefully, it's going to be an impulse to make the dramatic changes that we need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I think it's so powerful. Because I think our culture really promotes a sense of shame and personal responsibility mm-hmm. around your life falling mm-hmm. apart. And it's actually really empowering to realize, oh, we're all right on the edge of disaster. Right. So why not just go for it?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I think especially thinking about your, like, your listenership out in Spokane, like, it's important also to be precise that it's not really any particular people or persons or kind of people's fault. It's the system, you know, it's the way that we produce things, the way that we make decisions. Like that's what's wrong. What's wrong with things here. You know, it's the fact that capitalism can't sustain itself and has to cut corners and throw people under the bus and exploit people to make things work. And at the same time, it sets us up as the workers who actually have, you know, the power in our hands to move, do things differently.
Yeah. Well, and that kind of leads right into what I like to ask people every interview is, and you've already touched on it a lot, but like what is kind of getting you through the objectively tough times that we're living in, and what is like powering your involvement in this movement in terms of like longevity and sustainability and hope, mm-hmm. and all of those things.
I mean, what the major thing as always is community. I mean, having friends and comrades who have my back, and you know, even small material things, but also immaterial things like having someone call when you're freaking out or having someone to just watch Netflix with you. So it's that community piece. But another big piece to me is study. And I think that's kind of understated sometimes, but really striving to understand the world and not just in reading books, but in listening to podcasts and watching YouTube videos and talking to my friends, like trying to figure out what's going on in the world and getting a glimmer of clarity that really helps me anchor, mm-hmm. And be able to feel like, okay, I know why I'm doing what I'm doing. And I know what my priorities need to be. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of resources out there these days. So mm-hmm. people should take advantage of them.
Knowledge is power, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Cool. Well, and then if people want to learn more about Burgerville Workers Union, about Burger Union movement in general, where's the best place for them to...
Yeah, we do a lot of work. A lot of our outbasing work on Facebook. You can go, we're at the, you should just go into Facebook and search Burgerville Workers Union. We're also, our website should be back up. It's BurgervilleWorkersUnion.org, all one word. And the new burger campaign is called Little Big Union. And if you just search Little Big Union on Facebook, that should come up too. They also, I think they also have LittleBigUnion.org. So yeah, check us out, like us, follow us, get inspired, make it happen in your own community.
Cool. Is there anything else you want to add?
Much love to y'all in Spokane. I'm excited to see the movement grow and hear what y'all are up to.
Cool. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. If you're just tuning in halfway through the show here, you're listening to Praxis. That was an interview that I recorded this past weekend in Portland with Louise Brennan. He is working with Burgerville Workers Union, as you heard. We also talked back in 2016, if you want to hear it. Early historical perspective from that same organizing. And I, as he mentioned toward the end of the interview there, they do have a pretty active Facebook page that has updates and news on everything that's going on. And I just shared that in promoting today's show on my Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/praxisradio, PraxisRadio. If you want to read more about everything that's going on with these specific fast food workers organizing, if it's inspiring you to start organizing in your workplace or someone you know who's disaffected in their workplace, there's all kinds of resources out there. There is a, as he said, there was a really in-depth article in Willamette Week last week that is available online that I will link to. There's also just today a long in-depth op-ed about the announcement of Little Big Union and some of the context related to Burgerville Workers Union in Teen Vogue by Kim Kelly, because it's 2019 and Teen Vogue is actually has all the answers sometimes and some really great in-depth reporting. So they have a piece that's up, and in the opening they talk about the fact that obviously, as we said in the interview, and as most people just instinctively know, fast food workers are among the lowest paid and most marginalized workers in American society, and usually don't have a lot of power because of the giant monopolies that control fast food in general, the turnover in that industry, etc. But according to this article, there's more than 3.65 million people working in the fast food industry in the country, and at least 52% of them are dependent on public assistance. So there's a lot of reasons why this affects everyone and why, yeah, we should all be paying attention. And like I said, being inspired by this movement that's happening in our region with our neighbors and comrades there in Portland. So hope that you liked that interview. I've got, like I said, some more stuff from this weekend that I will be sharing over the next couple days. And I do want to start this week with something that I'm going to incorporate a little bit more formally in the future. And by in the future, I mean starting next week, starting on these April shows. I'm going to be doing some reformatting on the show. So I'm going to be doing some more history. I used to do a lot of history shows in addition to interview shows, and I want to start combining them all into one. So doing a little bit of both in the same show. So I'm going to start doing some on this day, inspired by some other great projects like Working Class History. If you've never listened to their podcast or followed them on social media, you definitely should. Yeah, just a little way to infuse some continuity into all of the things that we talk about. So coincidentally, after doing a labor interview, today's history, there's a lot of great labor history that happened today, great and not so great. So the first is today, on this date in 1911, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire took place, which folks probably remember, even though it catalyzed a lot of radical labor history that we learn less about. This is something that you might have learned about in your traditional education. So yeah, in the afternoon, March 25th, 1911, a fire broke out on the 8th floor of the Ash Building in New York City as the young employees of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory were preparing to leave for the day. And that fire was exacerbated because the doors of the factory would be locked during the day to prevent workers from leaving, from taking breaks that weren't authorized. So the workers, most of whom were young women and some of whom were children, were not able to leave when the floor caught fire. And that fire killed 146 people, nearly all of them Jewish and Italian immigrant women and girls who worked in the garment industry. And it was the deadliest workplace tragedy in New York City at that time, and actually throughout history until 9/11. So, it galvanized Americans to join that fight for basic industrial safety, things that we really take for granted now, really was part of the era that I think most people think of when they think of the American labor movement, that time in the early 20th century, you know, and in that interview talking about the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, being the catalyst for this fast food organizing in Portland. I mean, this was also just a banner time for the IWW and for workers organizing in general, for things that we now really take for granted, such as unlocked doors in factories, basic safety, lack of child labor. As I said, some of the people who died were girls, were children. 8-hour workday, etc. So what's interesting that I learned in researching this fire and this history is that even before the factory burned down, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory was known among workers and among those paying attention that it was kind of already known as a bad place. They were very anti-union, and kind of exceptionally dangerous, more dangerous than the already dangerous garment industry. So the owners, Max Blank and Isaac Harris, designed the layout of the sewing machines on the floor to minimize conversation and maximize production. They fined their workers for talking, for singing, for taking too many breaks. So hence the locked doors also. So yeah, that is something to remember. There's a lot of articles and things that you can pretty easily access. I'll post some information as well. So yeah, never forget, keep fighting, etc., on the labor front. And, coincidentally, there's another piece of labor history, and this I'm sharing from the Global Nonviolent Action Database, which is a really cool resource that, again, I will link to on the podcast notes. Today is also the anniversary of the kickoff of a major strike, in Canada in 1872, the Toronto print workers struck and kicked off their initial strike wasn't successful, but it kicked off the 9-hour workday movement in Canada, similar to our 8-hour movement here, but actually a little bit earlier to around the same time. So I'm gonna read a little bit about that for you as well. So, let me find where I want. Okay, so the Toronto printer strike was part of the 9-hour movement. The 9-hour movement was an international workers' movement striving for shorter work days in the 1870s. In January 1872, in Hamilton, Ontario, railroad workers as well as other craft workers formed 9-hour leagues. 9 hours was normally a reduction of 2 to 3 hours off a regular shift. The workers explained that society as a whole would benefit from shorter work days because individuals would have more time for family and community. From Hamilton, the movement spread to other parts of Canada, notably Toronto, Ontario, and Montreal, Quebec. The movement gained support from smaller Ontario towns, as well as including Sarnia and Perth, and from regions as far east as Halifax, Nova Scotia. This came to be known as Canada's first mass workers' movement. Toronto is important to the 9-hour movement because it was there that words were transformed into action. The demands that had started in Hamilton were taken up by the Toronto Typographical Union. When these demands were not met, the printers threatened to strike. The employer stated that the demands of the union were, quote, foolish. The printers went on strike on the 25th of March, 1872. They focused on liberal George Brown and his newspaper, The Globe, but engulfed all newspapers based out of Toronto. The one exception was The Leader. The owner and editor of this paper, Tory MP James Beattie, stated that the shortening of the hours of labor is one of the most commendable movements inaugurated by working men. Beattie was said to have been keen to see George Brown suffer as a result of the strike. On April 15th, 1872, the printers led a parade through Toronto, starting at the Trades Assembly Hall on King Street, marching down Yonge to College, and finishing at Queen's Park. The parade included marching bands and signs proclaiming the demands of the printers. The group started the march with 2,000 individuals, and by the time they had made it into Queen's Park, the crowd, made up mostly working-class individuals, had grown to around 10,000. At the time, the population of Toronto was 100,000. The employers fought back in several ways. They brought in replacement workers from small towns to fill the positions of the workers on strike. They also started an association that opposed the movement called the Master Printers Association. George Brown was recognized as leader. The Master Printers Association launched legal action against the Toronto Typographical Union for conspiracy. At the time, the activity of unions was considered to be a criminal offense. On the day after the parade to Queen's Park, police arrested the 24 members of the strike committee and threw them in jail. Those arrested included John Hewitt and John Armstrong, leader of the Toronto Typographical Union. Hours after the arrest, citizens met in Market Square to denounce the Master Printers Association. Prime Minister Sir John A. Macdonald, seeking support from the workers and seeing an opportunity to embarrass his political rival, Brown, introduced and passed the Trade Union Act on April 18, 1872. The act legalized and protected union activity. The printer's strike did not lead directly to 9-hour workdays. In the short term, the strike was damaging to the strikers. Many lost their jobs and had to leave Toronto to find work elsewhere. The strike also led to many positive outcomes. Unions were legalized, and the public showed that they were interested in their own affairs. After the strike of 1872, almost all unions began to demand 54-hour weeks for their workers. The printers of Toronto were indeed pioneers in the struggle for shorter work weeks. So again, that is from the Global Nonviolent Action Database, which I'm sure you'll be hearing more from because it's a great resource. And as I start to do these little history plugs. So, yeah, if you think about 1872, obviously long ago, but not so long ago, and looking at Canadian history and then also U.S. history. So we go from the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in 1911, just as one benchmark that happened to have happened today. But moving through all of the major gains of the labor movement immediately surrounding that time period, and then the sharp decline that we see when right-to-work laws start to pop up in the 1940s, mid-1940s, and kind of the modern era of union busting begins. And then through the rest of the 20th century, corporate consolidation, power of capitalists in general in our society just balloons into what we see now. So it's very interesting to have been able to talk to some of these organizers in Portland, to talk to workers who are working on these things, to look at the growth of worker-owned cooperatives in this weird moment where we kind of have a vacuum. We kind of have power consolidating in other ways, and seeing what happens when workers and normal people find their own power. So it's a pretty cool time to be around. It's a pretty strange time to be around. So I hope that you enjoyed hearing some of that about these workers organizing, hearing how it fits into the past and all the rest. So I'll be back with a brand new show next week. And all through the weeks after that, there's a bunch of great stuff coming up in April. I'll be talking to David Barsamian, host of Alternative Radio, during his trip here, talking to some folks about immigration activism, talking to some folks about Venezuela, talking to folks about the criminal justice system, efforts locally and around the country, and so much more through the spring. So thanks so much for listening. If you missed any part of the beginning of the show and want to hear it, you can find it by going to kyrs.org, going to shows and finding Praxis and navigating from there. Or you can look up Praxis on iTunes, Google Play, anywhere you get your podcasts. Or you can go directly to soundcloud.com/praxisradio, PRAXISRADIO. In other news of history today, it is the late Aretha Franklin's birthday. So I'll send you out with some Aretha Franklin. Thanks so much for listening. I will be back next week. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio.